Hello and welcome to another episode of City on a Hill, a podcast about what it means to be a citizen of heaven and a citizen of the United States. We want to encourage Christians to find their tribe in the church and their hope in the kingdom of God, rather than to seek both in the kingdom of man. So with that, let's get to it today.
Well, hello, I'm Eric Estep.
And I'm Scott Reevely.
And this is the City on a Hill podcast. Welcome back, listeners. Welcome back, Scott. How you doing?
Whoa, I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine.
Do we want to start?
Well, we could explain to the listeners. So I'm preaching this week, and it's on the woes, the W-O-E's, towards the Pharisees.
Jesus says woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, and then he goes on seven different times.
Yeah, seven woes.
So it's on the woes.
Yep. And I was making a pun about woe, like, whoa, watch out, this is crazy. And I spelled it out and realized that my entire life I have been spelling woe incorrectly, and Scott just pointed this out to me. W-O-A-H is not how you spell woe.
Whoa.
In fact, I went to search on my computer to prove myself right, and I have a Mac, so it pulled up all the messages that I have typed woe for years, because, oh yeah, look, that's me writing this out in my text messages.
If you received a text message from Eric that has where he's like slowing you down or he's impressed and he says W-O-A-H, then now would be a really good time for you to like just reply to that text and say hi.
I wasn't referring to the World Organization of Animal Health or anything. It was just incorrect.
Ooh, that's cool.
So
whoa, hold your horses on this, right?
Exactly. So maybe there's a time in your life where you've realized you've done something wrong or wrote things incorrectly your whole life. And maybe today you're going to realize the way you interact with Jesus in politics is the wrong way. We can maybe, hold you back.
Wow. Is he the master of transitions?
No, it's like JV in a junior high squad, I think. So last several weeks, we've been talking about the Old Testament passages that involve politics, and I'm going to let Scott regroup himself. And we're going to jump to the New Testament, and we're going to engage Jesus in politics. And I am a little bit serious about reading it a different way. I think for myself, reading about Jesus and how he interacts or talks about the kingdom or kings or politics, I kind of have slid past it quite a bit. And once you realize something political is happening, he's speaking in a political way, you actually go, wait, I think I've read this incorrectly the whole time. So we're going to talk about Jesus, and I hope you guys have that reaction.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you start at the very beginning, his birth, it's real clear that the gospel writers want to connect us with God's story and his redemptive plan from the Old Testament. But Matthew starts his gospel with a genealogy of the royal lineage of Jesus. And so the verse 1 says, Son of David. Mm-hmm. So you know where the whole Old Testament is going, because the very first verse, or whole New Testament is going, because the very first verse in the New Testament says this is about Jesus, the son of David. Mm-hmm. And that is a kingly title and a plan, essentially a plan that God has had to establish a ruler on David's throne forever. And so Matthew starts that way in verse 1, then gives a genealogy. And then he really tells us the story of Jesus' birth by contrasting him with the insecure tyrant that is over that area at the time. His name's Herod. And as you know, the wise men go in and they say, well, there's been a king of the Jews, and Herod gets all, you know, fired up. And then they go worship Jesus and don't come back to Herod, and he wants to kill all the children, all the baby boys in Bethlehem. under a certain age. And in all of that is because he recognized, and really you have this from the very beginning of the New Testament, the recognition that a king or a political ruler is on the scene. In other words, it would, just from his very birth, it would be hard to imagine that you could make the Christmas story more political than it is. And I say that because if Christmas is just about, you know, reading the story and babies in a manger and animals and stars and angels and stuff, I completely just blew by this. But the intent of the Gospels is to say there's a new king, or there's a new sheriff in town, and you're going to have to come to grips with this new king. And, you know, I say Matthew because Matthew really is trying to establish his kingship, but Luke does really the very same thing. And as you talk about, or you read the Christmas story from Luke chapter 2, it says, "In those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration when Quirinius was a governor of Syria. And all went to be registered, each to his own town. And Joseph also went up to Galilee, from the town of Nazareth to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child." Now, that's how the birth account in Luke, the one that we read the most at Christmas time, starts. And
I almost feel like it's snowing outside.
It might be snowing outside. I turned the heat up because it was cold today. But it does feel like Christmas just reading that. But what you've got is you have Jesus placed in the context of world rulers. Caesar Augustus, Quirinius, Judea. He went to Judea, which was Herod's jurisdiction. He was of the city of David, again, another political referent. And not only that, you have registrations, you have governors, you have really all these things that are political in nature. In other words, it's not like, you know, he said it was, it's a dark and stormy night because he wanted to tell us about the weather, or that it was, in the time when they were inventing something so that there's economic or, some sort of other reference. The whole context is political. And so all the references about Jesus' birth, and you just have to say, is that an accident? Did he intend to place Jesus among the world rulers and have us recognize we're going to have to come to grips with him?
Well, and a king is showing up, and you've referenced Son of David, but last week we talked about the Davidic covenant, the covenant that God was going to set up a king forever.
Right.
And so for the very first bit of the New Testament to be the Son of David showed up, that's the king showed up. The king that that God promised would be forever has shown up within the context, within a smaller political context, but the king nonetheless, and now going to be, would you say, in tension with all of those actors?
Oh, 100% in tension, and still in tension.
Yeah.
That's I think.
That's why we have a podcast.
That's what we're talking about here, exactly. And you just can't overstate it hardly. And because, again, I don't know how I always thought of Jesus as, I don't know if he just had some religious ideas, if he was a good man, if his birth was some sort of warm, fuzzy thing that we have in the middle of the winter. I mean, how did I miss the fact that he came here in conflict from the very beginning with all the world rulers? The wise men came searching for a king. Herod turns murderous in attempts to wipe out the king. Bethlehem is King David's city, and it's in the shadow of Herod's summer palace. I mean, you just can't get this more dialed in in politics.
Well, to answer that question, how do we do that? I think, and we've talked about this many times before, but I'll I'll just engage my normal rant about this. I think we take the spiritual and compartmentalize it off. And then when we talk about the kingdom of heaven, which is becomes Jesus's refrain over and over and over again, we read heaven and think something in the clouds, that's in the spiritual realm. And now I'm going to go, oh, there's a kingdom of heaven. That sounds nice. It's probably in my heart. And there's a throne in my heart.
Harps and wings and, you know,
and I think we do that and then read through all these things and say, oh, that's not a flesh and blood kingdom. That's not a land and dirt type kingdom. That's a spiritual kingdom. And it's something different than what I'm experiencing throughout throughout my life, throughout my days. And I don't think that's accurate. And what happens in Matthew, in the context of the political, it says in Matthew 4:17, from that time Jesus began to preach, saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And if you know what the referent for heaven is really, think about the place where God is. Earth is the place where man is. Heaven is the place where God is. And really what Jesus is proclaiming is the kingdom of heaven is here and going to reconnect with the place where man is. And Jesus becomes that like focal point. And the kingdom he's proclaiming is not simply a spiritual or compartmentalized or something in our minds or our hearts. It's a real kingdom with a real reign. And if you start with that premise and then start reading through Matthew, all of a sudden, okay, actually this is in conflict with everything.
And real political demands.
Right.
I mean, shall we say it that way?
Yeah, that's good. And we go to the Beatitudes in Matthew 5 after he starts preaching about the kingdom. And I'll just read this starting in verse 2. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the poor, pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So he sets up like those who we should celebrate, those who should be said of them, congratulations, are those who are acting in a way that aligns with the kingdom. And even you have kingdom of heaven several times here, and you have the earth here. And the earth is not just a secondary prize. It's no, these things are together in some way. And if you're acting in the kingdom of heaven way, meek, you inherit the earth. So there's, it's not like, oh, you can stay behind.
That's good, Eric.
Those are connected.
Yeah. And it, again, when you see this, you get the idea that the kingdom of heaven runs differently,
mm-hmm.
or contrarily to the kingdom of earth, the kingdoms of earth.
Right.
That the way that life is in the kingdom is different. The political demands of this kingdom then are different. The demands of the kingdom of heaven are to be poor in spirit and mourn and be meek and hunger and thirst for righteousness, be merciful, pure in heart, peacemakers. That's the way the kingdom looks. Now, the reason that's important, I think, is because when we get fired up about politics, we forget the kingdom of heaven.
Mm.
We forget this right. kingdom way of living, and we start saying we have to live in the same way as everybody else. In fact, we have to do it better than them and get, you know, and beat them at their mm-hmm. at their kingdom game
right.
instead of play Jesus' kingdom game. So
yeah.
Anyway, no, I think that's really instructive.
So there's the Sermon on the Mount, and then time after time, Jesus begins just teaching these parables, these little stories about what the kingdom is like. And here's just a couple. We don't have time to go through all of them, but there's many. He says, he put another parable before them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed that a man took and sowed in his field. It is the smallest of all seeds, but when it has grown, it is larger than all the garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like leaven that a woman took and hid in three measures of flour till it was all leavened. And I think this speaks to he's proclaiming the kingdom of heaven is at hand. This is going to start small, but it's going to take over everything. This little seed is going to be so big, you're going to have birds hanging out in the tree of this thing. So it just speaks to the eventual expansiveness where, as he's preaching, he's just this guy walking around with no place to lay his head. You wouldn't expect him to be a king. but he is the king, and he's proclaiming what will happen.
Again, and he's trying to help us recognize that we can live in the kingdom of heaven now, and mm-hmm. that living in the kingdom of heaven now, we have hope that for the day when the kingdom of heaven will invade the whole lump of flour, or
right.
the kingdom of heaven will, you know, grow into bloom into this mustard tree, really.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, again, what we're trying to do here today is establish that Jesus came not as just a nice guy in a toga or in a bathrobe or however you view him. He came as a king to establish a new kingdom, the kingdom of heaven here on earth, and then make disciples who in turn would establish, you know, beachheads, you might say, or embassies of that kingdom that represent that kingdom in the kingdoms of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
We call that the church. But anyway, one of the things that makes me realize that's what Jesus is doing is his choice of disciples. We go quickly to the fishermen because mm-hmm. those are the first ones we hear about, and they, you know, they throw the net on the other side and they get a big catch fish, and that sounds all great. But the reality is there were 12 of them. One was Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. That really leaves 11. Of the 11, there were two that are really, I don't know if you can say it this way, it's probably an overstatement, but were chosen because Jesus thinks the kingdom of heaven should be trans-political. It should be beyond the politics of this earth. And I say that because he chose Matthew, a tax collector. So Matthew was hated by the other Jews because he was loyal to Rome. In fact, he was collecting taxes for Rome. He mm-hmm. was skimming off the top, like all the. That's how the tax collectors got their, you know, pay. Maybe I don't know if it's all their pay, but they certainly got bonuses for doing that. And so he was hated by the Jews because he was loyal to Rome, and that would have been hard enough for him to fit into this other group of Jews who were fishermen and, you know, oddballs of other kinds. But Jesus also,
who were probably not liking the government at all, who were requiring these taxes of them.
Yeah, I mean, the normal rank and file mm-hmm. person who doesn't like to pay their taxes.
Right.
Let's say it that way, yeah. And then Jesus also recruited Simon, who was a zealot. And a zealot wasn't just someone who didn't like to pay their taxes or every April 15th, you know, fast. He was part of the political party that had dedicated itself to resisting and overthrowing Rome.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he could not, I mean, zealot is a good word because he was fired up about that. So here you've got Jesus pairing up this Roman tax collector and this, you know, anti-Rome zealot
mm-hmm.
in telling both of them, I want you to rather than be partisan, I want you to be co-members of my new kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to learn how to put aside your partisan ambitions, really, or your partisan benefits and all the things that come to your partisan identities. That's probably the best way to say it. And identify yourself in the kingdom of heaven. And I think I just like that because that is so instructive for the church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the church has people who have various levels of political or partisan identities.
Mm.
And the call of Jesus on our lives is the same as it was for Matthew or Simon. And that is to set aside those other identities and recognize our primary identity now as a member of the kingdom of heaven following Jesus. So
mm-hmm.
anyway, just the choice of, I mean, if there was nothing else political about Jesus, just the fact that he made those two guys get along
That's wild.
As part of a 12-member church. I mean, it's one thing if your church is like several hundred and you don't have to see them very often.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same small group, these guys were in the same small group on purpose, chosen by Jesus on purpose to be in the same small group. So they figured it out. So anyway, I think that's wonderful.
Well, and I hadn't thought about it till just now, but Matthew, the tax collector, wrote Matthew. So you have this supporter, if not like just willing and welcoming the Roman government. And then he turns around and writes this whole gospel about Jesus who's proclaiming the kingdom. That's a...
About King Jesus.
That's a dramatic turn. And, I mean, that'll get you killed in that type of scenario. What he was doing, I'd never thought about that before. I think that's pretty profound. So Jesus talks... Jesus has, I feel like, a different posture with politics than we do, or at least the tension. And one of the ways the tension that comes out is in Luke 13. It says, at that very hour, some Pharisees came and said to him, get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you. This would be a ancestor of the previous Herod who wanted to kill him.
Not a descendant of the previous
Herod. Yeah.
Whoa.
that's
no problem.
Painful.
No problem.
They said, get away from here, Herod wants to kill you. And he said to them, go and tell that fox, behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I finish my course. So at least at one level, he's proclaiming, I'm doing stuff for this other kingdom. I'm casting out demons, performing cures, things are happening, and I'm not going to let the existing kingdom dissuade me from... I'm not going to run away in fear because this might happen. I'm going to keep doing what this kingdom does. And he calls him a fox. So, Scott, do we think that's just a pure insult and that this gives us license to just call people whatever we want, or something more, he's maybe crafty. He's trying to do some schemes. I recognize his schemes and I'm going to ignore them because I'm not going to let them affect the kingdom.
Well, I think some of it is he's kind of making sure that in his own heart and mind, and then in the minds of those who are warning him, at least, that Herod gets, stays in his place.
Mm-hmm.
That he doesn't have more importance or power
right.
than he should have. And so just go and tell that fox, mm-hmm. I'm going to cast out demons, perform healings, and I'll finish my course in due time. And it's not a... It's
right.
not an issue, yeah. Which is interesting because he does, in that respect, he doesn't deflect it because it really, but he just sort of says it's just what the government wants to do is not that important to me. Mm. I mean, that's the way that I would take that.
Well, in this particular portion, the existing government is trying to jump outside of its bounds and stop the action of the kingdom of heaven. And he's kind of saying, no, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, it can't.
Right.
It can't do that. And some of it is, it's a little bit tricky because the Pharisees came and tell him this. So I don't know if they're hoping to intimidate him into stopping or whether Herod's actually trying to stop him. Mm-hmm. But either mm-hmm. way, there is some political pressure that should incite fear here.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus says, nah.
Right.
It's just, but we talked about it a couple weeks ago, it just shrugs, mm-hmm. really, basically. Mm-hmm. We talked about shrugging when we talked about what Jesus did with near the end of his life when the Pharisees came again to say, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And he was aware of their malice and said, why do you put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax. They brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to him, whose likeness and inscription is this? And they said, Caesar's. Then he said to them, therefore, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. And, we talked about that just a few weeks ago. But so we won't spend much time at it other than just to enjoy Jesus saying, Caesar does have his image on some things, but they're not near as important as the things God has his image on. And so, you belong to God. Mm. But yeah, there's a lot to say there, and we said it a couple weeks ago, so that's we won't
go back and listen to that episode.
Yeah.
Towards the end, this was, that passage was maybe th- 3-4 days before his death, and then you have really some extreme interaction with the government, whether trials or interaction with different leaders, culminating in his death on a Roman cross. But during that, there's a lot of political talking that, again, we might just glance over if we just go, oh, it's spiritual, not really anything going on. But one of them comes in John 18, says, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, but that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world." Then Pilate said to him, "So you were a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." And this underscores, this is not just, Jesus' kingdom is not just a small, local, regional kingdom that would gain power by the means that all the other kingdoms are gaining power. He's doing something different. And he even says, if this was like a normal of this world style kingdom, maybe it's Rome or Greece or Persia or the Medes or whatever, and they kind of fight and gain different advantages, he says that's what would be happening. My servants would try to maybe push Rome back, maybe do the zealot style thing and push Rome back, and we're going to take over again. But he says that's not what's going on. And when Pilate says, "So you do say you're king," and he, the coyness of Jesus is always so interesting to me. He says, "You say that I'm a king," but then he underscores it again. "For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world." So yeah, I am a king, and this is why I'm here. But it's something bigger and more comprehensive than the kingdoms that Pilate is used to.
Well, the thing for me in this text is Jesus very clear that his kingdom is different, not merely in the fact that it's heavenly or somewhere else or however you want to think of heavenly kingdom, mm-hmm. but the means by which that kingdom does business is different than the means by which the kingdoms of the world do business. And it's hard to overstate that for me, because that's, I think, where the Christians tend to miss on their interaction with politics as we know it, mm-hmm. because we think we've got to beat them at, you know, their thing. Jesus says their thing isn't, if my kingdom was like their kingdom, yeah, then we do
the same thing.
Then we do it the same way. My kingdom's not of that, so we don't do it the same way. And I just wish, I mean, that's just one of my prayers for this next year, is mm-hmm. that Christians would recognize the kingdom that we're fighting for is not of this world, and so we're going to live like those Beatitudes you read earlier, mm-hmm. in, rather than say we need more power, we need more numbers, we need more of our way in the world. That's not how Jesus is doing it here. Right. So it's really the whole means, the idea of means to an end is really important, I think, in that text. Mm-hmm. Just the next chapters, a few verses later, Pilate says to Jesus again, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" And Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." And again, Jesus recognizes, first of all, that Pilate does have authority over him. Clearly, Pilate does crucify him later. Mm-hmm. But the authority Pilate has been given to him from above. In other words, it's just exactly like we talked about in the Old Testament with Jesus essentially establishing government for the dominion of the world. It's like we talked about in Romans 13 last week too, where God has ordained these authorities, and here Jesus is saying the same thing and then submitting to that authority as that authority crucifies him. Mm-hmm. When he could have called his servants, he could have called angels, he could have at least put up a fight. And I say that because we think, oh my goodness, we're going to lose, and at the hands of, you know, our government or a government. Mm-hmm. So we have to put up a fight. And here, Jesus, number one, recognizes its authority, submits to it to the point of death, mm-hmm. without putting up a fight. So anyway, I do think there is, again, some lessons here for us on authority.
Well, I just think it's so astounding to be the giver of the authority and then the submitting to the authority nonetheless as it does the thing it should not have done.
Mm-hmm.
That's just astounding that Jesus submitted himself to that and really for us, like to remedy everything. But it's just that's a hard relationship to get your head around. God, Jesus, delegated this authority to Pilate, to Rome, and then went and sat within that authority, submitted himself to it, and then they kill him. And that, I'm not often thought about it in those type of terms, because usually we're just talking about the death in general, not in mm-hmm. not in this political sphere. But that's pretty astounding. Then later in, actually the next verse, from then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, Jesus, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." A lot of tension here, but just the really the Jews in this particular context siding and saying we're going to pick Caesar over Jesus, and then pushing against Pilate on that as well. Like, be careful, you have other authorities that will get you in trouble, Pilate, if you don't basically if you don't do what we want you to do.
So this is really interesting to me, because while it looks 100% like it's the one who makes himself a king, really a couple of verses later, they say crucify him, and mm-hmm. The Pilate says, "You want me to crucify your king?" And the chief priests answer, "We have no king but Caesar." So this whole side by side King Jesus versus King mm-hmm. Caesar, that whole side by side thing is in one hand clearly political.
Mm-hmm.
In another hand, Caesar expected people to worship him as a god. So the whole political scheme had this religious dimension to it that was going to add pressure to all of your political decisions, add religious pressure to all your political decisions. And here now you've got King, you've got it right straight away in conflict between King Jesus and Caesar,
mm-hmm.
and everyone makes their choice. And I just wonder, you know, how much Christians in America end up making this same choice in order to have the king that we think is going to, or the president, shall we say,
right,
that we think is going to give us what we want. And I just think we have to go back to even things like this. Our hope is in the kingdom of heaven and in King Jesus. So,
well, I also wonder, I think outside of this abnormal context with Jesus going through these trials and the Jews pushing Pilate and the different governors to crucify him, I think outside of that normal context, they wouldn't really want to say, "We have no king but Caesar." That's not their MO in general, especially they're monotheistic. We're going to worship Yahweh only. And so to recognize Caesar as king would be something they would be averse to. I'm not going to do that. But when pressed, do you choose Jesus or do you choose Caesar? They have to choose one of them, and they choose Caesar. And that's, I think we are often faced with an allegiance question in a similar way. And maybe normally, in a normal context, we go, "Oh, no, of course not. I would never say that." But when put to it, are you going to choose the kingdom or not choose the kingdom? Which game are you going to invest yourself in?
Yeah, I mean, to just push that a little farther, since you raised it, this is on Eric, not on me, just so you know, if you don't like what I'm about to say, it's on Eric.
I don't even know what you're about to say.
It's just, if you said the next election or the next thing that I have to do, a decision I have to make politically, is for the good of America or for the good of the kingdom of heaven? Mm. Which would you choose? Mm. And I think those kinds of, to frame the, frame our political engagement, our engagement with government in those terms, you know, we're put to this same question.
Right.
You know, nobody, anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar. We have no king but Caesar. And then the church is going to have to decide, you know, what if we have to make a decision in the fall, mm-hmm. About what's good for America or what's good for the Church of Jesus? Mm. Where are people going to fall on that decision? And that's the, you know, that's almost exactly the decision here.
Right.
Is what's going to be good, for, I mean, they're deciding for Caesar instead of Jesus, but I just hope the church doesn't do that.
Yeah. Well, and I think the way to prep ourselves for that is to continue to steep ourselves in passages like this. And what is the kingdom? Get a good understanding and realize, one, that Jesus is really more political than we expected. We just went through a bunch of passages that we probably that we glossed over in the past if we're just thinking about the kingdom in a different way. But this is all within the tension. And then Jesus relates to politics and government in a way that we should imitate. So read a bunch of this and go, okay, well, how did Jesus do that? And how did Jesus do that? And how did Jesus do that? And begin to practice now when the stakes are less high, because it's good to practice when it's not the bottom of the ninth. Mm-hmm. Practice now and imitate the way Jesus does things.
Yeah, if we could do the render unto Caesar like he did, and we could be that wise in the moment, that would go a long ways, mm-hmm. for people's esteem of Jesus and his kingdom. Mm-hmm. That would be great. I think clearly too that all of these texts from the birth of Jesus to his death tell us that political leaders neither understand nor are willing to submit to the authority of Jesus, because he threatens their authority, really. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I would say, and this is from really from the gospel, from the whole New Testament, that Jesus' political vision for the kingdom and his authority as king are the grounds of our ultimate hope. Mm-hmm. And so really this whole little meditation we've just done on the kingship of Jesus and the glory of his kingdom is nothing but a rehearsal of our ultimate hope.
That's good. Well, great. Well, for future rehearsals, specifically through Scripture, don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and rate us. If you find what we're doing helpful, a review goes a long way to getting this to other people. Do share it with someone. Send it via text. Tell them about it. Say, I am trying to learn how to have a good posture towards politics, and I want to mimic Jesus, and this seems to be helping, and maybe you can help some other people as well. If you have questions, send them to comment@cityonahillpodcast.com, and we look forward to the next conversation.